From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The discovery of mad cow disease in the United States has knocked the flu right off the front pages and hit the American beef industry where it hurts, in the cash register. The government has moved quickly to try to reassure meat lovers, but this story is not over, and the details are not appetizing. Tonight on Point, mad cow and an inside look at the industry of beef. But first, an American Black Hawk helicopter on a medical evacuation flight has come down west of Baghdad, killing all nine passengers. The U.S. military is investigating the cause of the crash. American helicopters have become a popular target for Iraqi insurgents. Joe Cochran is a correspondent for Newsweek in Baghdad. I asked him about this latest helicopter crash.
It was a U.S. Black Hawk helicopter, a U-860. Carrying nine U.S. military personnel that made an emergency landing, and it was actually in Fallujah. It was a crash landing. No official word, but there's rampant speculation it came down because of ground fire, most likely a rocket-propelled grenade. It was believed to be on a medical evacuation mission in the area. There are reports that the helicopter had a Red Cross sign on it, meaning it was a medical mission. But things like that certainly don't stop the insurgents. They feel that any U.S. military targets are open game.
Joe, what is the U.S. military saying exactly at this point about the downing?
Currently, they're investigating it. They have not confirmed that the helicopter went down because of ground fire. They said it made an emergency landing. One Army spokesman had said the helicopter was on a routine mission, while another spokesman for the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S.-led reconstruction effort here, said it was on a medical evacuation. So we're waiting for official word, but reports came in from witnesses who saw a rocket fired from the ground into the air that struck the helicopter and forced it down.
And the nine dead, were they all U.S. military personnel?
That's correct. U.S. authorities have confirmed that.
Joe Cochran, there have been a number of helicopters that have come down. In November, I think four, killing about 40 U.S. troops. Just last week, another one came down near Fallujah. This must be a primary means of transportation in Iraq for the U.S. military. How serious is the threat to the fleet of choppers there now?
It's a very serious threat. Of course, the U.S. military has state-of-the-art helicopters, but they are susceptible to ground fire. And the insurgents do hit-and-run maneuvers where they might hide in an area, spot a helicopter, or know an area where a helicopter is going to be. Then they pop out, they'll fire a rocket-propelled grenade, and then disappear again. So it's very difficult to defend against this kind of attack. Helicopters are a very practical and primary means for transporting troops as well as supplies to certain areas across Iraq. The roads aren't always secure. Large convoys of military vehicles traveling outside Baghdad are susceptible to ambushes, roadside bombings, and suicide car bombings. So helicopters are certainly a major weapon that the U.S. uses for transportation of troops, supplies, as well as for military operations.
Joe, are these repeated attacks on helicopters then forcing any change in U.S. operations between the threat on the ground from roadside ambush and bomb and the threat in the air? Is it crimping U.S. troop mobility in Iraq?
It's hard to say. The U.S. military really isn't going to comment too much on their modus of operations. There has been talk among private security analysts here that the helicopter pilots need to change tactics. Perhaps fly lower initially, where they might be able to see the threat, and once a rocket-propelled grenade is in the air, they can move up or to the side to avoid it. Now, the U.S. military has not publicly commented on the tactics that its helicopter pilots are using or might use in the future, and I doubt they will for security reasons. But certainly something might need to be done because the insurgents remain determined to go after helicopters, which are very high-value targets.
Joe, the day before the Black Hawk came down with its nine dead, there was an attack on a U.S. air base north of Baghdad, mortar attack, killing one soldier, wounding 33 in the living quarters area there. What's the tempo of attacks been in recent days and weeks? Is it up, down, steady?
Well, there's been daily attacks. You don't hear about all of them because some might be a mortar fired at a building in northeast Iraq where no one's injured, and sometimes that information doesn't filter out and down to Baghdad to the media. other attacks are deadly. Anytime there's a deadly attack, certainly the U.S. military has to announce it. The attack yesterday was at a U.S. base, a logistical base, around 6:45 p.m. on Wednesday local time. And it was a mortar attack that struck in a living area where soldiers have their sleeping quarters. So it sort of came out of nowhere, typical hit-and-run attack. These have been occurring all over Iraq over the last several months since the U.S. took over. And despite the fact that only one person was killed, it's just an example of the daily assault that the insurgents are placing on U.S. forces. They aren't stopping. They're doing whatever they can to hit the U.S. forces.
Joe, the number of U.S. war dead is now approaching 500 in Iraq, several thousand wounded, many quite seriously. What's the tone of the U.S. military spokespeople there these days? They were quite upbeat after the capture of Saddam Hussein. Are they still?
Yes, they're still quite upbeat. They claim in press briefings, and they remind us of this quite often, that the number of daily attacks on coalition forces has gone down over the last few months, and specifically has gone down since the capture of Saddam Hussein in December. So they feel that they have the upper hand here. They say since Saddam's capture, they're getting far better intelligence on the ground, especially from local Iraqi citizens who feel more comfortable talking with them, or maybe realize there's no danger of Saddam Hussein returning, so they want to be more cooperative. So the tone is upbeat. They do acknowledge that these attacks continue. They're taking the insurgency very seriously, and they have numerous operations in Baghdad and around the country to try and weed these terrorist cells out.
And yet the attacks go on. 9 dead in that Black Hawk crash. Joe Cochran, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, take care.
Joe Cochran is a correspondent for Newsweek. He spoke with me from Baghdad. By the time the dairy cow in Washington State tested positive for bovine spongiform encephalopathy last month, its meat was already in the American food chain, ground up for hamburger and sold in any one of 7 states. In the weeks since, 30 countries have stopped importing American beef. The USDA has banned the slaughter for food of cattle that cannot walk and reassured beef-eating Americans. But the Agriculture Department is not calling for widespread testing for mad cow, and public scrutiny is throwing a hard light on both the disease and industrial beef production in general. Are you still downing burgers since the mad cow scare? Are you paying attention to the gory details coming out of the feedlots and slaughterhouses? Is the mad cow threat being overblown or brushed under the table? Do you know what goes into your beefsteak? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire, professor at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, and contributing writer for The New York Times. In March 2002, his article in The New York Times Magazine, Power Steer, shocked readers with its depiction of the U.S. beef industry. Now he's writing about beef again in the upcoming Times Magazine. Good evening and welcome, Michael Pollan.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Michael Pollan, it was a year and change ago that you adopted, I forget if it was a steer or a beef cow, and tracked it right through the U.S. beef industry, all the way from feedlot through slaughter and into the stores. Your head must have whipped around pretty quickly when the mad cow news came out last month. Where's your perspective taking you in the week since? What are you focused on now?
Well, what's concerned me, you know, 2 years ago, as you said, I did follow a cow, a steer. I bought a steer, actually, mm-hmm. and followed him through the whole process and began to get an education on how we produce beef in this country that I think now just about anyone who's metabolizing has had. It's been all over the newspapers. And I think what's really struck me is this is one of those episodes, like many other food scare episodes in recent history, that kind of, you know, throws back the curtain on the system by which we produce our food in this industrial food chain.
We're going to look more closely at mad cow and exactly how it gets introduced, how it can be prevented, the subtleties, and they seem to be extreme subtleties of how it might be transmitted. Mm-hmm. But give us that picture with the curtain pulled back for a moment. What are the striking things that you saw before that you're seeing in probably even sharper relief now that most Americans don't think about when they've got that Marlboro country image in mind of cattle on an open green field?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that cattle spend very little time on open green fields anymore. By the time that they're weaned, which happens at 6 months, We take them off grass, which is, of course, what they're evolved to eat, uniquely evolved to digest, because they're ruminants. And we put them on feedlots in the interest of speeding up the process of getting them to slaughter. If you leave a cow on grass, it could take 2 or 3 years to get a 1,100-pound steer ready for the slaughterhouse, whereas if you put them on the feedlot and feed them lots of corn and lots of protein supplements and lots of animal protein from other species or their own species and give them hormones, you can get them to slaughter in less than 14 months. And, you know, efficiency is the name of the game in the whole American food system.
Something like 39 million cattle slaughtered every year in the United States, if I've got that number correct. To take us into the details of that, that the people still might not really have focused on, of how that turbocharged raising of the cattle is supplemented. Calves with being fed cow's blood, is that right?
Yeah. Usually that's in the dairy industry where you, you know, you don't want to waste the milk of the mother cow on the calf. So you buy an inexpensive milk replacer. And as we learned last week, that milk replacer very often is made from cattle blood because it's cheap. You know, there's a reductive logic here. Protein is protein. Fat is fat. Calories are calories. So you look for the cheapest form, and they're all interchangeable. And if it just so happens that the cheapest protein around to give your calves or your cattle is protein from other calves or other cattle, you do it, or you have done it until recently.
And it doesn't stop there. Of course, the feeding of, I guess, cattle to cattle directly has been banned. But cattle parts, and you have to tell us what that means, are still fed to other species, to chickens, for example. And somehow the chicken protein comes back to the cattle. How does that happen, Michael?
It can. It's a very convoluted food chain we've devised for these animals and therefore for us. The way it works is you can no longer feed meat and bone meal from cows to other cows.
Though that went on for quite a while before it was banned.
Apparently. It's been going on since World War II. Mm-hmm. But increasingly in the feedlot system in America, it became very common that you would take the slaughterhouse waste, render it, dry it, turn it into feed. It was protein, and you fed it back to the cows.
Turning herbivores into carnivores, as you might have it, Michael Pollan.
Basically, that's what we've been doing. Yet there are, even with the ban that started in 1997 as a result of the mad cow episode in England, I was quite surprised to learn, still feeding parts of cattle to cattle, just different parts. There's the blood, which is still legal to feed to them for some bizarre reason, given that the blood contains protein and that there
protein
is some
which,
evidence.
Which may be the vehicle for mad cow. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and there is some evidence that it can be conveyed. I mean, you're not allowed, if you lived in England during the mad cow episode, you're not allowed to give your blood to anybody.
But ground up cows are fed to chickens.
Well, they had to get rid of all this, mm-hmm. all this extra cattle protein from the that they were rendering. So it is still permissible to give it to chickens. Now, chickens are omnivores. They eat a lot of different things, and they do eat meat. They eat bugs all the time. You can also give it to pigs, who are also omnivores. The problem is, though, what if and you're allowed to give the meat from the pigs and the chickens back to the cattle. So you've got two things to worry about.
That's a little euphemistic. You describe it. It's called chicken litter, and it's like all the waste from the chicken pen, including the chicken feces protein, that goes back to U.S. cattle.
Well, that's a serious danger. And that although it's not a widespread process, there are feedlots in America, particularly in the South near the chicken growing area, where chicken litter is an acceptable feed. And the problem with this chicken litter, as you suggest, is that it's got all the feed that the chickens missed, in addition to their feces and the bedding. And that missed feed may well be the meat and bone meal from cattle.
Michael Pollan, we just got 20 seconds before the break here, but are you making an aesthetic critique then or a scientific critique of a threat to health here?
My first reaction to all this, and I think I share it with a lot of Americans, is, however, whatever the scientific risks of this process are, it's really disgusting. And that is an aesthetic critique. But as I'll explain later, I don't think that it's trivial for that reason.
We're talking tonight about mad cow in the meat industry, the industrial agriculture that puts steak on your plate. You can join the conversation. Are you still downing burgers since the mad cow scare? Are you paying attention to the details that are coming out of the feedlot and the slaughterhouse? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mad cow and the meat industry, about the industrial agriculture that puts steak on your plate. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you really want to know how your meat gets from ranch to plate? Is the mad cow threat overblown or being downplayed? And how much more would you be willing to pay for a pound of beef stamped mad cow free? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Michael Pollan from talking with us tonight from Berkeley, California. He's written for the New York Times Magazine on the American cattle industry and will write on that again in this upcoming Sunday's magazine. We're joined now in the studio by George Gray. He's executive director of the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. Good evening and welcome, George Gray.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. There's more that we want to hear about this, George Gray, but you have looked very much in depth at the whole mad cow threat and what to really make of it. We saw what happened in England. 130 Britons died, millions of cattle there slaughtered. No one wants to see any of that happen here. The U.S. has been ferocious in responding to mad cow in other countries, closing its borders very quickly to Canada and other countries where mad cow has appeared. What's your assessment at this point of the USDA's response to what's happened? They've stopped bringing downer cattle, that is, cattle that can't get to the slaughter line under their own steam. They've stopped bringing those into the food chain, but they've stopped short of testing all cattle for mad cow, as is done in Japan and is done to some great extent in Europe. Have we done enough?
Well, in many ways, the situation we're facing right now is something that the USDA came to us and asked us to look at. They wanted to know about
the risk. This is before it ever showed up. This is much
before
it ever
showed up. And they said, we've done an awful lot. In 1989, we closed the borders to the UK. We haven't brought in beef or beef products from there since then. We closed the borders to all of Europe in 1997, trying to keep mad cow out.
Of course, those are relatively easy steps, and U.S. cattlemen really like it because they sell more beef then.
That's certainly true. The other thing we did that the cattlemen didn't like very much was imposing this feed ban that we've already talked about, this rule that says you can't use that protein from cattle to feed cattle. That was done in this country in 1997 in the absence of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
What USDA came to us and asked is, given the situation, have we done enough?
Mm-hmm.
And we evaluated the state of the U.S. agriculture system. We went to slaughterhouses. We went to rendering facilities. We went to cattle markets. We went to farms. And the results of our analysis suggested to us that even if dozens of mad cows got into the United States, the disease would not spread very widely. So on the risk side of this, the risks of the spread of mad cow in the United States are really quite low.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, human exposure to the bad bits of a cow, you remember that the milk, the meat have been tested and don't transmit this disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's the central nervous system primarily.
It's the spinal cord and all that.
Either through direct consumption or through some contamination that we identified to the government. There's a little bit of exposure, but not very much. So what I would say is going into the Washington State situation, the risks were pretty low. I think some of the steps that have been taken at this point are steps that will make that low risk even lower. Keeping downers out might help.
What else has been done? That's all I've heard about.
The most important thing that's been done is to pull what are called specified risk materials. Essentially, we're taking those bad bits of a cow, the brain, the spinal cord, some other bits of the central nervous system, out of animals that are over 30 months of age. That's where the high-risk population.
That is taking them out before they're slaughtered, before they're put into the food chain.
And they cannot go into the food chain. So they're taking those high-risk materials out of the human food chain. In the past, you could still go and buy a cow brain in the grocery store if it's what you wanted to do.
Michael Pollan, I know that your reporting is saying that this so-called advanced meat recovery system, and I guess that's some kind of, I don't know, hydroblasting of the carcass, is so efficient at pulling flesh off the spinal cord that some of that spinal central nervous system material still gets into, let's say, frankfurters or bologna.
Yeah, well, the study I read said that 35 out of 100 times, if you test the meat coming out of that system, which is, as you say, it blasts jets of water against the meat at such power that it removes every bit of possible flesh, 35% of the time there is central nervous system tissue in the resultant meat.
So, George Gray, what about that? Is that still a threat or not?
Well, AMR was actually something that we identified.
Advanced
meat recovery is something that we identified in our report.
It's a terrible phrase, but I suppose it does mean efficiency.
But there are what it simply does is take the bits of the bones after the meat's been trimmed off by hand and extracts the rest of the meat by tumbling
blasting
them. We identified to the government that, in fact, other than eating brains and spinal cords, this was the biggest potential source of risk from BSE for human beings.
Is it still going on? Is it still in my baloney?
No. Well, in fact, this new regulation has been put in place to remove the spinal cords and all those parts from these animals is pulling them out of AMR, too. So, in fact, advanced meat recovery, if it even stays around, and there are plenty of reasons to think that the market may push it away.
Mm-hmm.
But it has been made even safer through steps that have been taken just in the last 2 weeks.
And what about Michael Pollan's critique that there's something just against nature in the way we serve protein up to our livestock? That any source of protein is fine. Forget the image of cattle on the great green meadow or the high chaparral. You know, they ate other cattle. They eat, you know, what comes out of the bottom of the chicken pen. That there's something against nature here, that it's kind of flouting evolutionary rules. Is that just a poetic objection here? You've looked closely at it. Are we swimming upstream against evolution with all that, forcing animals to eat things that they wouldn't naturally eat?
Well, this is something that I'm glad you actually made the distinction right before the break, this difference between scientific and aesthetic. Maybe is it risky or is it revolting?
Mm-hmm.
The risky part I can talk about. The aesthetics of this is something that I'm just not knowledgeable about. But I really do think that we need to look at the way in which we try to be sustainable, to use all the parts of, to be efficient in our use of materials as a society.
Michael Pollan, you're tempted to tie these two together, the risk and the way things look.
Well, you know, if you look at animals, they have evolved certain kind of hygiene rules for themselves. In general, you know, they're not cannibals. They don't eat their own species because there's extra risk of infection. They avoid their own feces. They avoid their own, the dead carcasses of their fellow, of their kin. And we share some of these revulsions, I think. And it may be hardwiring. It's very hard to say. But one of the things we do on feedlots is force animals to overcome these deep-seated aversions, these aversions that they've evolved to protect themselves, and we give them antibiotics instead. So I think there is some, you know, there is some point, I think, where the aesthetic and the scientific overlap. I don't think they're completely at odds. And the warm and fuzzy feeling we get at the idea of grass-fed meat, animals grazing on grass, as they've done for tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, and as we've watched them do for that long, there may be a reason that that is an appealing image. And whatever you say, it works. I mean, you know, it's not a novel system. And I think we should always be somewhat suspicious. And the burden of proof for their safety must be on novel systems, such as, you know, turning herbivores into cannibals. Wait, before we do that, let's think, could there be a problem with that? Is there a reason that nature made them herbivores? It seems to me these are at least questions that we have to consider before we cross these thresholds.
But George Gray, you're not ready to smack your cowboy hat on your thigh and yahoo all those cattle back out into the pasture. So given the way that they're raised now, what do you think about universal testing, the kind that goes on in Japan and in Europe for mad cow? Is it a waste? What I heard you say earlier suggests it may be. Or is that what it's going to take to, A, reopen overseas markets, very important to the American beef industry, and ultimately to keep the confidence of Americans themselves, beef eaters though they are?
Well, I think there are two parts to your question. It's a good question. The first one is on this question of the confidence of other countries and of our own consumers. Public perception is an important part of the way in which we react to these things. On the other side, though, is what are the real risks? What's the scientific evidence? On the scientific side, these mad cow is a funny disease. If I made a cow mad today by feeding it the brain of another mad cow, I wouldn't know it was mad. It wouldn't show symptoms that I could see for 4 years or more.
Mm-hmm. And during that time, would it be dangerous to a human who ate its flesh?
It would be very slightly dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But any test I have to look for it wouldn't find it. So I could make myself feel awfully good by testing and testing and testing and testing animals that I know I would never find positive.
So you're saying, like in Japan, they're testing all these animals. Some number may have mad cow and just not show up because it doesn't show up for 4 years.
Testing a one-year-old, an 18-month-old animal going to slaughter is not going to find mad cow disease, even if it has it. I think some thought about focusing on high-risk populations, which is where surveillance has been going on in this country already.
That means what's
high-risk
population?
That means older animals.
Okay.
Essentially, animals that are old enough that they could be over 4 years of age.
And they've had time to develop a more advanced mad cow.
Right. And we animals that might be showing signs of things or symptoms that would make us think that perhaps they are more likely to have the disease. These down animals. In Europe, where they've started testing all older animals,
yes,
down animals have a much, much higher rate of mad cow disease.
That should tell us something. But we've been eating them hundreds of thousands of years until last week.
We've been eating some of them.
Some of them? I mean, it's
down animals is a mixed thing. I've been to plenty of slaughterhouses.
Yeah.
And in those places, there is a human being I presume, a meat-eating human being, an inspector from the government, who has to say that each one of those animals is ready for human consumption. There are a lot of pressures on them. They may not do the best job in the world, but it's not like we're just taking anything off the street and eating it.
George Gray, Michael Pollan, stand by. I want to welcome a rancher into our conversation. Mike Calicrate is joining us from Denver, Colorado. He's owner of Calicrate Feed and Ranch Food Direct. He's got 10 or 12,000 head of cattle at any given time. Mike Calicrate, good evening and welcome.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I wonder, as a man who raises beef and puts it out to American consumers and until a couple of weeks ago out to the world, I'm sure, what do you make of the whole flap over mad cow? Are we taking the right precautions or not?
Well, I don't think we're going far enough. As far as what I make of it, I know how it impacts our pocketbook. It has lowered live cattle prices from 20 to 30% to the owner of those livestock.
And, that's pretty sharp.
It's put the guys on the farm and the ranches in a terrible strait. People who are already in serious financial trouble are now in much deeper financial trouble. The thing I'm worried about, though, is not so much BSE and the threat to my health or my family's health. Mm-hmm. I think what we've done with this case of mad cow is, as Michael Pollan said, we have pulled the curtain back. And what I see is a corrupt USDA. What I see is a Secretary of Agriculture that works for the meatpacking and retail industry rather than for the people.
Put some meat on the bones of that charge, Mike Calicrate. What do you mean exactly?
Well, what we've seen in USDA is a revolving door from industry to the agency that is supposed to act in the public interest. And back again, in fact. And in fact, if you pull up the Wall Street Journal today on page A4, cattlemen saddle up for duels over rules. And it lists all the people from the NCBA and other industry groups like ConAgra and others that are now in the Department of Agriculture.
So there may be a revolving door. What's the consequence of that Americans should be concerned about?
Well, the consequence is that they're able to lobby and block good legislation, rulemaking, that would protect our food supply. Basically, what we've seen the USDA do as a result of this revolving door and all of these industry people being in the USDA is they've globalized and industrialized the food system. And as Michael Pollan said, it has certainly become an industrial system whereby many things are threatened. Our food safety is threatened as we import and globalize and search the world for the cheapest meat that we can bring in and sell in this high-consuming market. We inspect very little of it. In fact, it was Bill Lehman on the border of Canada at Sweetgrass that basically lost his job for being too aggressive on the inspection. In fact, he said, they're so lazy in Canada, they can't even take it out of the Australian box when it comes in. And so we've got wide-open borders. Talani Francisco, FSIS, Food Safety Inspection Service veterinarian that inspected the Mexican border, spoke to the group at RCAP about 3 years ago, and she said that she couldn't sleep at night realizing how open the border is. And this is at the time of mad cow.
You're being critical of beef coming into the United States, but what about American beef itself? You're part of that industry, Mike Calicrate. Is there something wrong with the way it works?
Well, I think there's a lot wrong with it. I think we're wrong in feeding cows to cows. In fact, I wrote Oprah Winfrey a letter of support, a cattleman for Oprah, sort of speak, when she was worried about her hamburgers. I think it is wrong to use hormones on cattle to promote growth. I think it's wrong to use subtherapeutic antibiotics in livestock that reduce their effectiveness on people. I think it's wrong to overly confine and pack these animals into these industrial sort of environments.
So are you an organic, free-range rancher, Mike?
Our cattle are natural. We treat them with a lot of care and respect. We feed them natural rations, and we've got a much higher quality product as a result.
But is American beef, is it really dangerous, or are you then just looking for a market opportunity in the distress of the larger industry?
Well, I obviously am looking for a market opportunity around the industrial system. An independent producer cannot put his toe in the water with the big meat packers and their retail friends and expect to sell to a consumer. The market is too predatory. You can't get shelf space, so you've got to do something outside of the system, and that's what I've decided to do. But I don't know as the meat supply is unsafe, but it is certainly an industrial food supply. And we talk about this science issue. The problem we have, unlike UK that uses a precautionary principle, You know, we consider everything safe until proven harmful. It's kind of like the FDA with being in bed with the drug companies. They look at FDA's or the drug company's data and make decisions based upon that, only to find out that the product isn't safe down the road, it's harmful, and or is not effective. Same thing happens in the beef industry, and we hear this word sound science all the time. And basically what I call it is smoke and mirror junk science. We really do need to test things. We need to figure out what mad cow is, what causes it. I think we need to look at other theories like Mark Purdy's theory. We need to put some money behind it, and we need to stop being blocked by USDA and all the lobbyists in Washington that only look out for big business.
My calculation, stand by. George Gray, you hear the natural rancher here shooting some big artillery at the general, the big beef industry in the USDA. It's corrupt, smoke and mirror science, and all the rest. Do you hear the core of a legitimate criticism here, or do you see somebody scrapping for market share?
Well, I don't know what Mike's motives are, but Mike has made the choices he's made, decisions he's made, and he thinks what he thinks. When I look at this from a public health and an animal health perspective, I keep coming back to the fact that when we look at things, even if we don't know where mad cow disease came from, and you cannot find scientists who will tell you where they came from, we know how to stop it. And in fact, in a precautionary move in this country 6 years ago, we put in place a system to stop the spread of the disease.
To stop, we test something like 20,000 cattle out of 36 million.
Test,
I read.
And in fact, right. We've only just started to test that many. You know, one of the reasons we found this case is we just recently increased the number of cattle we test. We used to test a couple hundred a month. And the prediction on the was always that, well, if we start testing more, we're going to find it. Now we test 20,000, and we found it. And I think if we tested 100,000, we'd probably find more of it. You've got to look before you're going to find it.
George Gray, fair criticism?
Well, I think I still come back to the fact that what I care about is whether this disease will spread, whether people will be exposed, and people could get sick. And I believe,
and we really don't know the answer
place.
To that question.
No, we know enough to know. We know what stopped the disease in Europe. We know what shut it down in the UK from 1,000 cases of mad cow a week. Down
with
virtually
different
nothing.
Rules,
was it the testing that shut
no,
it down?
No, testing doesn't do anything to stop
what
the spread
was it exactly?
of the disease. The feed ban. If one cow mm-hmm. cannot make another cow sick, the mm-hmm. disease cannot spread.
Mike Calicrate, do you buy
cows,
that?
People don't get
well,
sick.
Well, the problem I have is, again, an agency that doesn't work in the public interest, FDA, did not enforce the feed ban. There are companies still feeding that were still feeding the meat and bone meal that didn't even know about the feed ban. One particularly in Tacoma, Washington, just recently stopped selling feed with meat and bone meal in it. We've got ineffective government agencies, and I would argue that the industries that they should regulate have taken them over.
Mike Calicrate in Denver, Michael Pollan in Berkeley, and George Gray right here with me. Stand by. We're talking tonight about mad cow and the meat industry. You can join the conversation. Is the U.S. government doing enough to keep the U.S. meat supply safe? And what does the beef industry need to do to reassure you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about mad cow and the meat industry, the industrial agriculture that puts steak on your plate. You can join our conversation tonight. What does the beef industry need to do to reassure you? And what about industrial beef production? Is it an offense to nature, to you? Didn't we already know it's not pretty to see sausage made? Is the mad cow scare telling us something bigger or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Denver, Colorado by Mike Calicrate. He's owner of Calicrate Feed and Ranch Food Direct. He runs 10 to 12,000 head of cattle in Colorado. From Berkeley, California by Michael Pollan, professor at the University of California Graduate School of Journalism. He's written a lot on the American cattle industry. He's author of The Botany of Desire. And with me in the studio tonight, George Gray, executive director of the Harvard Center for risk analysis. Right now, Drew is calling from Waukon, Iowa. Hi, Drew. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
Just great. Thanks, Drew.
Good. Hey, I just had a couple points to make. I'll be real quick here. Say, I just wonder, you know, this guy from Denver, Colorado, and he's in the organic market. Is he kind of pushing for his product to sell better out there?
We've raised that possibility, Drew, but what do you think? What about the general concern?
Well, the general concern is it's a concern of everybody's, but I think we're doing a good job of trying to test, identify it, and obviously we did identify it in Washington State, but the in my view, the media is blowing this way out of proportion. I guess in Iowa here, I don't think anyone's cutting down their meat, but it sure has affected our beef farmers and the markets around here.
Are you in the
it's
beef
also,
industry yourself, Drew?
I'm in the dairy industry.
Okay.
So it's also putting, you know, when you close those borders, it also affects the dairy industry as well. So I think we're putting a little bit too much scare out there to the American public. And I think I'm not afraid to go out and have a burger or a steak or anything.
But, you know. Drew, you know that when Canada got mad cow, we shut our borders down right away. And right now, 30 countries around the world shut their borders to U.S. beef when this first came out. That must be serious for this industry.
Well, it is. And I'm glad we caught it. But I think we found that that animal did come from Canada, and it was a problem in Canada. I don't think it has proven to be a problem in the United States.
Drew, we got it. Thanks for your call, and thanks for your perspective.
He raises an interesting question,
yeah, Mike Pollan,
Tom,
yeah, yeah.
Which is, what does it mean to say, you know, that's a Canadian cow or a Canadian problem? You know, in the age of free trade and in the age of NAFTA in particular, it is one seamless market. From a biological point of view, there's no distinction between Canada and the United States.
Well, but there's still a border that's been policed there, and Canadian imports were shut down when mad cows showed up there, right?
Yeah, but it's, you know, I mean, talk about the cow having already left the barn. I mean, you know, the feed is going back and forth over the border. The animals have been going back and forth over the border. And to comfort ourselves by saying that this is a strictly a Canadian problem, I think is may make us feel better, but it sure doesn't give me a lot of confidence.
Anna's
and
calling.
Also, Tom,
Mike Calicrate in Denver, please.
Also, Tom, let's not forget that the Canadian Livestock or Genetics Association reported that there are between 300,000 and 400,000 Canadian cattle in the American cattle herds currently. So what about those? Wouldn't it be smart to identify those cattle and segregate those and certainly test those?
George Green, does that make sense? Is it even possible?
Well, right now in this country, it's not possible to identify animals. We don't. We cannot track animals in the same way that we can track people, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I keep coming back to the fact that even if we don't know even not knowing where the disease is,
yep,
if it's here, we can stop it from spreading. I would agree with the fact that compliance with this feed ban that's out there has not been perfect. In fact, when we did our study, we found that that was the main way in which BSE could spread. It spread only a little bit, but that is
cows eating cows.
Cows eating cows. If you can stop this disease from getting from one cow to another, you can just choke it off.
And what about the decision Japan and Europe made to test cattle? You've pointed out the shortcomings of that, but it would cost, what, a few cents per pound of beef. Is it worth it for some marginal gain or not?
I don't know anything about the economics of this. All I know is that there are no tests out there that can detect this disease in its early stages, and we can do lots and lots of tests and not find anything. Europe, in fact, is only testing animals over 30 months of age, which to me makes a lot more sense than testing every animal.
Mike Pollan, what about that? Is there a consensus out there on whether or not more testing makes sense, even if it costs a bit more for the beef?
I don't know. But, you know, if it is only a few cents, I would think it'd be a good thing to do. I mean, one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, why are we enduring this risk, even if it's small? Why does it serve us as eaters of meat that our animals are getting blood products or tallow from other animals? This doesn't do us any good. This makes a few more pennies for the feedlot operators.
Well, but they might say this is an efficient use of protein, an efficient use of resources, Michael Palmer.
Well, efficiency. I don't buy efficiency. I buy food. I buy food that's healthy enough to feed my children.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that I gain nothing except perhaps some small advantage in price by buying food that has some unknown amount of risk attached to it.
And you might be happier with a little more comfort.
I think so. Or, you know, if this food system is not willing to reform itself, there are alternatives, as Mike suggests. There is organic, there is natural, and there is grass-fed. You can, you know, you don't have to eat off this food chain if you don't want to. And I think that one of the things that comes out of this food scare, and I put it in quotes because who knows if that's what it is, and has come out of every other food scare over the last 20 years, is that alternative food chains grow stronger, and I think that's a terrific thing.
Anna's calling from Boston. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
My point basically is that I'm, in addition to being basically disgusted by the whole, you know, thought of protein, you know, cow eating cow.
Wherever it's from.
But what really concerns me as a consumer is the lack of trust in the entire industry, the whole slaughtering dairy industry. I mean, I think some of the reports that have come out in news magazines about the conditions of how cows and how the meats come into our supermarkets have actually kind of made me think that that the system in itself cannot be trusted. And so the surveillance that the gentleman is talking about, yeah, okay, so the risk is little, but what surveillance is being done to really make sure that this is not something that's going to happen in another state?
I mean, you know? Who's watching the watchers? Who's making sure that they don't just hook it?
And is every little place, are all the risks really being looked at? Or are we going to find mad cow disease in chicken now? I don't know.
Or somewhere else. Anna, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Mike Calicrate, how about it? You pulled out the corruption word pretty quickly there before. But at the level that the USDA inspectors are working, do you trust that they're doing what they're tasked to do?
I know the inspectors are very unhappy. In fact, three of them work at my plant in Colorado Springs. So I talk to inspectors a lot. And I've talked to the union representative for the inspectors. And they're fighting to be able to do their job.
What are they unhappy about? What's the impediment?
Well, they aren't allowed to do their job.
What do you mean by that?
The big meat packers run roughshod over the inspectors. The inspectors are told by their bureaucracy at USDA in Washington not to stop the lines unless they are wanting to be responsible for the lost profits of a meat packer. And it just gets back to that revolving door and the power of the packers within our government agencies. And so I think we do have to put trust back into the system, and we have to do it by cleaning out the USDA of all of these compromised people and putting some folks in that really do want to do their job.
Or I would add, Michael clarifying Pollan. The mission. I mean, you know, the USDA has an impossible mission. It has two jobs. It has to promote sales of U.S. beef and mm-hmm. reassure consumers around the world.
Right.
And it has to assure the safety of U.S. meat. And
but those don't seem in conflict to me, because people want to buy safe meat. So don't they go hand in hand?
Well, if you're the USDA, you do not want to put out any negative information. Your goal is to just sell more of the stuff,
right.
To promote the interests of the industry. And frankly, as we've known since the time of the jungle, the industry's interests in safe meat are sometimes not as high as their interest in profits.
But sooner or later, that catches up with you.
We need an independent, a truly independent food safety agency that is not compromised by its ties to the industry.
Well, that is frustrating.
I mean, I think that's the first step.
But that ought to be the USDA. John's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. You're on.
Yeah. Well, two things. One, beef-rendered protein shouldn't be fed to any other species. We know that beef prions have spread to humans.
And this is the protein element that carries BSC, mad
right.
cow disease.
PR, it's an acronym. The PR stands for PR stands for protein.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we know it spreads to humans, cats, and minks. So what are we trying to get the chickens and the pigs infected? Why are we giving it to our pets when we know that cats can be infected with the stuff? The other thing is, this 97 ban was supposed to absolutely guarantee the public that the cows were not going to get any of this potentially prion-containing spinal cord, brain, and small intestine
from other beef, right?
Back to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got two ways they can get it now. They can get it from beef blood. We don't allow anybody to give transfusions that was in England at the time of mad cow disease, precisely because we're afraid of this. We know experimentally that sheep embryos have gotten it directly from plasma.
And you're talking beef blood that goes to the dairy cattle.
That is exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
The Nobel laureate says don't do that. You know, the precautionary principle should be predominant.
John, you sound like
efficiency of a rendering industry.
Mm-hmm. You sound like a pretty well informed guy. Let me ask you then: why do you think this is going on? I mean, it's only a marginal gain, presumably. If you took out this recycling of proteins, what percentage of profit would the beef industry lose?
There's a massive quantity of beef products that can't be used for human consumption that they've got an absolute use for. But the other thing that's even more egregious is that up to 30% of that chicken spillage, which they can feed right back to the beef.
Chicken spillage, that is chicken feces and
exactly.
junk from the bottom of the hen house.
30% of it can be this very banned, 97 banned beef brain, spinal cord, and lymphatic.
Oh, you mean not even digested through the chicken, just
that's
has fallen to the floor
exactly
of the chicken
right.
coop. George Gray, what about that? John's raising some pretty tough stuff here.
Well, I'll start with his last point, and chicken litter is, in fact, something that is of a concern. We identified that in our report to the government back in 2001. We said that was something that needed to be looked at, and I know that FDA has been spending time on it. I don't know what they were going to do about it. But I want to go back to this question of blood and blood products.
Yes.
One of the things that we have the advantage of is that the folks in England have done an awful lot of science on mad cow disease. Mm-hmm. We know that if you take the blood out of a mad cow and inject it directly into the brain of another cow, it does not get mad cow disease. We've tested different parts of cows to see which ones can transmit the disease. That's why people are pretty comfortable saying meat is safe, milk is safe. It's central nervous system tissue and a bit of intestine that you have to watch out for. So we have science.
Well, I think we've lost our caller, John, from medicine, but he didn't sound too comfortable with that blood transfer.
Well, I don't know if he doesn't know the science, but it's been tested and done into various animals by injecting it directly into their brains, not even feeding it, which we know is much less effective.
So you're saying we can live with that, and yet, gosh, it sounds like a well-informed guy, and we hear the level of unease with the way things work. Carlos is calling from Boston. Hi, Carlos. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for the program, first of all. Wonderful program. I wish more and more of this informed discussion would happen all over. Personally, I'm amazed. I'm really incredibly angry. The solution is so simple. It just don't feed animals to animals that are not supposed to eat other animals. I mean, the human beings have been feeding cows from grass and you know vegetables for centuries, and it was fine. I would bet you that if the public was informed, we would all gladly pay 10 cents more per pound and feed our kids good meat. Why are we even arguing? If we are talking about a few cents more, why don't we do it?
Yep, Carlos, I think I don't know who wouldn't sympathize with that. Everyone likes, you know, affordable food. On the other hand, everyone wants to have safe food. Michael Pollan, at this point, is this what you call the semi-circular food chain, that is animal protein being fed back to animals, is that so deeply entrenched in this massive American meat industry that it really can't be taken out? It's just the way it works.
No. I mean, I think what we're talking about here is the high cost of cheap food. We have very cheap food. Beef used to be a very special occasion thing. We had beef once a week in the middle class in this country. Now we have meat three times a day if we want at McDonald's or wherever. But we have only been producing meat this way for a fairly short amount of time. The feedlot system really grew up, and it began in the 50s, and it didn't take over the system till the 80s. There is no reason we couldn't go back to a safer, healthier, more beautiful system.
Mike Calicrete, are you there in Denver?
Absolutely.
Do you agree with that, or is it just too big? Things work?
I totally agree with Michael Pollan on that point. And one of the things that Carlos brought up is consumers gladly pay 10 cents more. The problem is it wouldn't get back to the farm and ranch gate. Farmers and ranchers don't want to feed cows to cows. The foot of the meatpacker retailer cartel is so firmly on the neck of that farmer rancher. He's squeezed out of every penny that a fair market should deliver him, and he has no choice but to do all of these things.
Well, we're going to be better informed consumers, and let's all hope we can find some good beef out there. We appreciate each and every one of you all being with us tonight. George Gray with me right here in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
George Gray is executive director of the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. Michael Calicrete in Denver, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Mike Calicrete, owner of Calicrete Feed and Ranch Food Direct, and Michael Pollan in Berkeley, California, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire, look for his article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.